Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Beyer. Let's get growing. Welcome to the show. I'm so excited to introduce my guest today, Elizabeth Leonard from Earl's Kitchen Gardens. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth's going to tell us a little bit about their business.
So we have a kitchen garden business here on Long Island, and we install and maintain kitchen gardens at schools and non-for-profits and at private residences. And we have about 50 clients, three of which are schools, one summer camp for underprivileged girls. And we've been doing this officially as a business for 3 years, but I have a long history in organic gardening and farming.
Okay, well, so that leads right to our first question. I always like to just kind of let our guests tell us about your very first gardening experience. Like, were you a kid? Were you an adult? Who were you with? What'd you grow? So go ahead and tell us about that.
I don't know if it's gardening or just like general love of the outdoors, but when I was little, my dad was such an observer of nature. Like, he loved to always walk around our yard, and he was such an observer of like all the seasons changing and the animals coming and going. And so he was constantly outside. He would spend like hours outside just walking around and kind of watching how everything changed and evolved and grew.
Now, So where did you grow up? Did you grow up on Long Island?
Sure. Yeah, I grew up on Long Island. Yes.
Okay. Yep. Me too.
In the middle of suburbia.
But it's amazing how many great nature walks and preserves there are on Long Island, and how you can get away and you can do things like that. I'm always amazed that. Go ahead.
Yeah, Long Island has like such a rich history too in agriculture,
right.
And it's kind of funny because it's been so built up and very populated, but now there's this like resurgence to really incorporate agriculture and make sure that we don't lose it here on the island. And that's, you know, there's a lot of organizations working to kind of preserve land either just for agriculture or just to keep it as open space, which is so important.
Oh, but good. That's good to hear.
Yeah, so I guess my gardening experience really was just being alongside my dad, and he was semi-retired by the time I was born. I'm the youngest of 8 kids, so he was I'm the last one in the litter. So I was home with my dad a lot, and so I think really his love of nature is kind of passed on to me.
Nice.
I like to always tell people I'm also allergic to the indoors. Like, I can't stand being inside.
<That's>
I think
great.
I really am allergic to them. So.
I love that. Aww. Okay, so then the next one is, so what does organic gardening or like earth-friendly gardening mean to you?
Well, when I was a teenager, I did, I don't know, maybe because you're out west a little bit, but I did a Knowles trip, which is the National Outdoor Leadership School. And one of the things that they teach you there is called Leave No Trace Camping, which is essentially like, you know, leaving the land exactly as you found it, taking everything out that you bring in. And I think the same organic gardening and earth friendly means the same thing to me. It's like leave no trace farming, working in harmony with nature, encouraging biodiversity, and following the rhythm of the seasons, like not trying to work against the land, but work with it. And all those things are really important if we're going to have a healthy ecosystem and something that we want to leave behind for future generations. So I really think, you know, leaving no trace is the best thing you can do. And I think, you know, we're in a society of like quick fix. And so people are constantly trying to buy things off the shelf that's going to remedy, you know, a pest problem or a disease that might be popping up on their plants. But the truth of the matter is those quick fixes aren't really going to solve your problem. You know, there's something out of alignment and out of whack. So I think organic gardening has a real purpose right now, and is very important, and really teaching people how to do it the right way, which I think is, you know, less is more.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of observing what nature is doing and understanding what nature is doing so that you can either encourage, you know, better outcomes through, you know, practical
That's what
methods.
I was thinking when you first started, was that, you know, a lot of the problems probably could even be prevented, and you wouldn't even need those things if you started. And I worry a lot about where we're headed. So,
yeah.
Well, that was a great
exactly.
answer. I like that. So then you talked about your dad. So is that who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques, or is there something else that got you going?
So when I was in high school, my brother started an organic vegetable and poultry farm.
Oh.
And so I had like my hands dirty a little bit when I was in high school helping him. But then I went to college in New England. I went to the University of Rhode Island. And in Rhode Island, there's tons of agricultural land, and it's just like awesome. And you have a lot of conventional farmers alongside new starting out organic farmers. So I worked in a conventional farm for about a week. And I was on the back of like this corn machine picking corn, and it was not for me. I was like, wow, this is really mass produced, and this is just when everything is just a number, and there's no integrity in this. There's no, even just to the point of what they deemed as a cull and what was good enough to go to market, it just was wasteful and didn't seem to make sense to me. It wasn't in harmony with what I thought organic farming should be, because it wasn't organic, it was conventional. So then I skipped to a different farm, Greenview Farm in Wakefield, Rhode Island, and that's where I really learned everything I know about organic farming. I worked there for 4 years, and it was just a great experience.
Now, were you studying agriculture? Or what, can I just ask, is that what you were studying at school?
So, nope, I was an art major.
Me too.
So I paint, and so I was at the University of Rhode Island for painting, and then I stumbled upon Greenview Farm, which was amazing because I needed a job, and so I saw that they were hiring, and they were just beginning. So, you know, from the soup to nuts of organic gardening, I got to really be involved. Like, we had to install deer fencing around 5 acres. We had to, you know, tap a water source that was underground. We had to come up with different ways to irrigate the property. I mean, at one point we were like hauling PVC pipes all over the place, trying to irrigate it that way. So it was, you know, like my first experience with putting down Remay over crops and seeding and making soil mixes for starter plants. It was just all everything. It was from the beginning to the end, to harvesting, to bringing it to the CSA and distributing it. So it was such a good experience because I really got to see how to start it up from the ground and get it going.
That's great. And you got a paid job doing that. It wasn't just like an apprenticeship or an internship,
yeah.
It sounds like. So bonus.
No, yeah, good, no, it was a paid job.
So did you draw that little watering can on your logo?
No. I'm a very loose artist. I do a lot of abstract. So no, that actually would be quite a challenge for me to do.
Okay. So then that's kind of probably how you learned how to garden organically, right? So.
Yeah. Yes.
Did you have anything
exactly
else
how
you wanted
just
to add
by there? Just the practices that we used on the farm, which was like, you know, with gardening, it's a little different than farming. With gardening, when you only have, you know, 5 tomato plants, mm-hmm. as opposed to a farm that has, you know, 5,000 or 500, it's, you know, you're so vested in that 5 if it's your garden. So some of the things that they do on a farm, you can't really do in a garden. You can't just accept that you're going to have, you know, a 5% loss on some of these crops, because you don't want to lose 2 out of the 5 tomato plants in your garden. So some of the techniques I learned, you know, you can't really apply to small scale gardening. Mm-hmm. But some of the things that I learned that are the most important, which is sometimes just letting nature run its course. You may lose certain things in your garden, but they may tell you a bigger picture. They may, you know, the fact that you have a Japanese beetle or the fact that you have aphids may mean that you need to take a little better look and pay a little more attention to what's happening in the garden. So,
all right. So then let's talk about this year. Tell us about something that grew well last summer, since it's
last summer. Yeah.
You're covered in snow.
We're covered in snow. My pride and joy are heirloom tomatoes. So I grow all different kinds, and I grow about 6 different kinds. And every year I try and add 1 or 2 new varieties to my own garden at my house. So, I'm like the queen of tomatoes, and I usually have way too many than I know what to do with, but I love them. And some of my favorites, I would say, are like Cherokee Purple, Black Prince, Striped German, Moscovich. I love them. I'm partly Italian, and so I remember getting tomatoes from this little old lady, and they were always knobby and bumpy, and they were never perfect. And those are like the best tomatoes you could ever have. So when people ask me for like a big boy or like a, you know, some traditional brand, or I don't even know what they're talking about. I'm like, no, that's not the kind. I have no idea what that is. Or sometimes even when people just want like a soft tomato, I'm like, oh, sure. Like I can grow you those, but that's not my pride and joy. I love the uglier and the the uglier the better, but I don't think they're ugly. I think they're beautiful.
I like that. So is there something that you want to try next year, grow new that's different, a different kind of tomato or something else in your garden?
You know, for my clients, like for all of the clients that I have, well, personally, I would like to grow more shelling beans, because I really, we're like a big bean-eating family at my house, so I would like to have more shelling beans for myself. But for my clients, I really want to incorporate more perennial plantings. I want to do fruit trees and herbs, because I think sometimes we have these like big empty spaces in the garden. And if they're just things that die back every year, you have this empty slate that you're returning to every spring, which can be really daunting and overwhelming. And, you know, it's like just a space for weeds to keep breeding. So if I can kind of get permanent plantings in there to kind of maintain those pieces of land, it would be great. And I think my customers would be happy with that too. I think having fruit trees, and figs, and, you know, all those things would be excellent. I also want to kind of try and get more of my customers to try and extend their growing seasons by doing cool frames and things like that. I think that would be awesome. And then personally, for my hoop house, I would really like to add barrels, like that you can collect water in, and you have these like dark black barrels, like 55 gallon drums that you can put into the hoop house, and it just, the water retains the heat. And so in the winter time, your greenhouse is heated just by these drums filled with water. They absorb the heat and they keep your hoop house warm, which I would love to do, because I think yesterday alone in our snowstorm, I was out there like bailing out my hoop house like 5 or 6 times.
Oh my goodness.
I know.
We use those big barrels to catch the rainwater. But yeah, it definitely warms them up.
Yeah, if you paint them black and they really like, and you can put a couple in there, it'll really be like a supplemental heat. I know people that use that, you know, that and compost, just by putting like enough mass in their hoop houses, they've got heat and it's great. I would love to have that.
I don't know if they sell them black or like the olives come. I always thought they were olive barrels that we were using, but
You know, out here in suburbia, they have them for, the car washes have them, and they're filled with soap, like detergent, which has been the only reason why I haven't wanted to acquire any of theirs, because I'm like, I don't know what detergent you're using. Yeah. And eventually I'm going to have to empty that water. So I haven't used them, but you know, sometimes you can find them on Craigslist. People are selling them, but most of the times they've been used for like a kind of industrial purpose. So I've been a little hesitant to get them. I'm kind of trying to source some clean ones.
I would check into that olive thing, because something makes me think ours had black olives in them. So that would be food, would be good. All right. How about something that didn't work so well this season?
In terms of plants, I pretty much had success with the things I grew, so I feel very lucky that way. I don't think there was anything that didn't really work out very well. But I think, you know, one of the biggest challenges I have is like empty spaces that, you know, just hand weeding. I would say something that doesn't work well for me is hand weeding. I'm constantly on my hands and knees at all my clients' properties, and sometimes it's really daunting, because it just seems like I've been here last week and I did this and now I'm doing it again. And you know, some of these weeds are really invasive. So there's actually this really cool guy, I believe he's in Japan, and I was just I just saw him on the internet the other day, and I was like, ooh, I have to really look into this. He's practically companion planting with weeds. He doesn't pull them. He doesn't dig them out. He's actually finding plants to grow alongside weeds where they don't compete. And he's had like these amazing results of like this just insane biodiversity. He's had like his yields have been phenomenal, where all of the neighboring farms around him are like, you know, doing the conventional like tilling of things in and just constantly like tilling them in. And, you know, I see that in my clients' yards. Like I'll be doing a garden for them and I'll till it under. And then it's like, I've just created a whole new mess of weeds in about 2 weeks. So I'm so intrigued by what this guy's doing in Japan, because he's basically using the weeds as companion plants and he's having success. There's like no competition. He's just figured out, you know, and there's something to be said about that, because certain weeds grow in certain places because it has the nutrients that it thrives on. So if we can figure out what vegetable is going to thrive.
That One Straw Revolution, that Manasobu Fukuoka.
I don't know
his name. Because the
I don't know, but
guest I just had on the other day from World Organic News, John Moore from Australia, was talking about a very similar thing, and I wonder if that's who it is.
I have to look this guy up. I want to know a little bit more about, and I'm so excited because this year I'm actually working with somebody who's a soil scientist, and she's into wetland preservation. So she's like a great resource. She sort of has this additional component that I'm so excited to tap into, because really that's the key to having success is really understanding soil and how this works and not fighting nature. You know, like I keep fighting these weeds, but they're going to win because this is the best suited location for them. They are happy as could be where they are. So if I can find a way to work with them, I'd be so excited because I'm so sick of pulling them out.
I think that's going to be part of the success. And I'm getting such amazing feedback. Like it's doing so much better than I ever could have anticipated. And I think it's because of people sharing things like that. Like I love when you say, I don't really have such a big challenge, because it gives people, you know, encouragement. Yes, this is going to work for me. And you know, some people say, you know, you always have something that doesn't work right and whatnot. But also to hear different gardeners say, oh, well, you know, I've been doing this for so long that, you know, I've kind of got my thing down and, you know, I'm being really successful. And I just, you know, I just want to educate people and share the knowledge that we can do this. And just, that was a great answer. And I love that, working with the weeds. And I'm so curious to, I might have to order that book right now then, The One Straw Revolution. Because I have a feeling that's who you're talking about. I mean, maybe not. Maybe there's somebody else out there, but be coincidence.
It could be. And it's so hard to keep up because it's so interesting. Like, you know, a lot of people can poo-poo social media, but if you stay within the confines of your genre, it's like if agriculture is your thing and not like Kim Kardashian, if you just stick with agriculture, like, the social media is just like booming with what's happening, and it's so awesome. It's like you've got a guy in the South Bronx of New York just blowing up and teaching children how to farm and how to grow food vertically in the poorest congressional district in the United States. And he's like amazing. He's called the Green Bronx Machine, and his name's Steve Ritz. And he's like, he's got gardens in the Bronx and he's feeding kids, and then he's employing his kids. They're getting paid jobs to grow food for their community. It's like there is so much out there that's happening in the good food movement, and it's just I don't poo-poo social media because we're all finding each other this way and we're sharing these ideas, and I think it's so good.
And I love that you are the outdoors girl and you're saying this. So do you do your social media outside? I mean, I'm like the mobile girl of the century. I write blog posts from the top of like Glacier Park on Mariah's Pass. I mean, I can do it anywhere. I laugh at like, I sit and tweet at night when I'm waiting for the paper to come out down, and just, I'm always on my phone. And my mom's like, oh, you're so into your phone. It's so unreal. And I'm like, no, it's not. It's like I meet friends who are interested when I'm interested in, and I feel like the connections I make on social media and look at podcasting really just boosts your connections to find people that are interested in the same things. It's a targeted informational stream. Like, I just look at people who are listening to podcasts. I'm like, just wait. You will be 5 years from now. I guarantee it. And, you know, it's going to switch because it just does connect you with people that think the same way you do. And it's making our world.
It's interesting, but we've never had. Yeah, we've never had, like, the ability to sort of cater to, like, whatever our interest is in this way. Now we can, like, edit out the things we don't want. Mm-hmm. And now we can bring in all the things that we're interested in. You know, it's like we can, like, curate whatever we want as opposed to being stuck, you know, watching commercials for things that you would never want to see. And, you know, it's so interesting. It's like,
and you're not limited to the people that are just in your own geographic location, which is the other thing I like a lot. Because I find, like...
Yeah, we...
Go ahead.
This year we... So... You know, I've been this business I've had for 3 years, but I wanted to see who else was doing what I was doing and how they were doing it. So I went on Instagram and I went on Facebook and I searched and I went on the internet and I found 6 other organizations that are doing what I'm doing, from North Carolina to Boston to Connecticut to New Jersey to DC. And we all, I shot them all an email and we all had like a conference on the telephone to talk about what we do and how we could do it better and what some of our problems are. And we had like 4 conversations back and forth, different, you know, phone conferences. And it was such a useful tool. And I would have never been able to find those people if it hadn't been for social media. It was everybody who puts it out there is easily found. And it was very beneficial to all people who are participated. So it was good. We had some people who were just starting out, and then we had other people who, like, one of her clients is Whole Foods, and she has a half-acre farm on the roof of Whole Foods in Boston, and that's just one of her clients. So it was like we all tapped into each other's resources and talked about how to make it work and how to make this really be people's livelihoods.
And Elizabeth, that is like the golden nugget of the podcast today, or maybe not. You've given us tons of valuable info, but it's so important. Like if you think, oh, I want to sell flowers for weddings, you know, and I want to get into that business. Well, you know, the best thing to do is reach out to other people that are doing weddings. Cause like one of my first guests, she was talking about, I don't grow roses at all. Roses are really hard to grow in my area. And you know, that would seem surprising to me, to somebody who's, you know, selling flowers for weddings. And there's just so much out there. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. And the most you can learn is from connecting with other people. And I just give you kudos for going out there and reaching out to other people. You know, it's not competition. It's an abundance.
No.
You have to have that abundance mentality that they're not your competition. Well, they're cooperating and you're all going to thrive. And your business is going to be a little bit different because you're a unique person. And so sharing is going to make both of your businesses thrive. And
at the end of the day, we're all human beings and we all have questions. It's like we all need to sort of bounce things off each other and see who has the right answer. And it was very funny because I think some of the things we all started talking about that we all had like a unifying issue. But at the end of the day, it was something that still remains unresolved for most of the participants in the conversation, which is okay too. It's like you know, now you kind of know that you're not alone in it. And some people are doing this, some people are doing that. But that was, you know, that was reassuring to hear too, that other people sort of have the same issues. So.
And everybody loves to share their knowledge. So it's nice when people like to have other people that are interested in what you're interested to talk to about things. And I find people are much more open and receptive to sharing than not. You know, you kind of get a little intimidated.
Yeah.
Like, oh, they're not going to want to tell me. And people usually do. If you care about something, they're excited to have somebody else who's passionate about what they are. So don't be afraid to ask people, audience.
There's also no trade secret. I mean, if somebody has like a trade secret that's like the golden piece of information, everyone's going to execute it differently. So it just, you know, I have a friend who owns a farm about a half a mile from my house, and I'm not competition to her because, as she told me, my dad always said there's enough for everybody. Yeah. And she's right. There's enough, you know, some people don't want a garden. They want to go to a farm stand and get it, you know, so it's different.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
All right. How about something you find that is easy to grow and is generally successful every time?
Cucumbers.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my God. They're, like, prolific. You grow one plant and you're going to have enough for a family of 5. But I also think like Swiss chard's another one that's really easy to grow. Kind of just like you can't kill it, and it just keeps going and going and going. And even after a freezing cold winter, the next year you're going to go out there and most likely that plant will come back to life. So I think lettuces, Swiss chard, cucumbers, those are all very easy things to grow.
And then,
I always tell like new gardeners, like start with like 3 or 4 things that you want to grow, and that's it. Don't get crazy. Like those garden centers are very tempting, but try like 3 or 4 things maximum. And then the next year add something new, or the next year after that add 2 new things, you know, but just get a handle on the things that you're doing. Otherwise, if you have like 7 or 8 different things going in your garden and you've never done this before, you're going to throw in the towel because you'll be overwhelmed. There's, you know,
mm-hmm. That's great advice. And that's so true. Start small. Yeah. And just things that you really like to eat too, I think is important.
Yeah.
And I hear that from a lot of people I interview, you know, start with, if you don't like to eat it, you know, find out if you're going to want to eat it before you buy the seeds. And especially, you know, might hear everybody's eating sunchokes or something, and then make sure you know, try them. And I saw them in the grocery store the other night. I saw a whole bunch of stuff that I was like, wow, I didn't even realize this stuff was here. Stuff that my mom has always grown in her garden, but just, I don't know. I was just surprised to see. But what was I going to say?
Right.
Swiss chard is so expensive. I go to the store I'm like, I'm never going to buy Swiss chard at the store. And then to hear that it
it's
grows.
It's like a garden weed. you can't kill it. I'll tell you, we have like 4.5 feet of snow, and I know that'll be one of the first things that pops back up. It's like, it's not
spinach.
Even supposed to, but it just does. Super hardy. So I have found, though, like in the spring, it's pretty susceptible to leaf miners, but those are pretty easy to handle. Like, you can either just squish the leaf with your fingers, and because you know how they burrow between, like, in the veins of the plant?
Yeah.
You can kind of, like, squish them with your fingers, or you can just pull those leaves off and chuck them.
Mm-hmm.
But they pretty much, Swiss chard survive, whether they get attacked by leaf miners or not. It's pretty good.
Yep. And I love Swiss chard. I freeze it a lot. So I have it during the winter. And I like to put Swiss chard in my lasagna. I know some people are probably cringing, but like Swiss spinach, and I'm a vegetable lasagna girl, and I'll put Swiss chard right in there. And I like to eat Swiss chard like celery, you know, the rainbow colored Swiss chard, like with just like some kind of dip or something. I love Swiss chard. It's one of my favorites. And it just kills me when, you know, it's winter and it's so expensive in the grocery store. And I'm like, I am not paying $3 for this tiny little bunch of Swiss chard.
Can you cold frame garden where you are? Or not really?
Not through the winter, but you can start. But we're working on expanding things, so who knows what my husband will come up with before we're all done. All right, how about something you would steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
Well, something, I have a lot of people who've never grown food before that are my clients. So they'll ask me questions, and I never want to laugh because I, you know, a lot of the people have never grown food before, so I don't like to laugh at them. But they'll be like, I stuck this avocado pit in some water. Could we grow this tree? And I'm like, no. So avocado trees, you can't grow them here on Long Island unless you have like some, you know, amazing setup of like some atrium or something that's going to... I would steer them away from that. I would also steer them away from, like, I have one customer who I love so much, and she told me that her great aunt is from Italy, and that she had to grow this one type of Italian zucchini called gugguts. Do you know what gugguts is, or cucuzzi?
No.
Oh my God. The seeds were brought over from Italy, and it's a zucchini that grows on a vine. The vine is about a 50-foot vine, so you have to trellis it up or over, and typically it grows like over your house, up your tree, across your garage. And the fruits, the zucchini, are anywhere from 3 to 5 feet.
Oh.
So the reason they brought them over from Italy is because they'll feed a large number of people, and it's a very prolific vine. So, you know, it was... and they do taste good. They taste like zucchini, but they have a little bit of a different flavor. But so I grew it for this woman, and it like went bananas all over her property, and we kept trying to contain it. And it was kind of like Little House or Little Shop of Horrors. It was like, oh my God, this plant. So I don't know if I would grow gugus or kukuzi if I was like new to gardening. I wouldn't
That's
do
classic.
That. Even though it grows really well in my climate, I don't think I would do that.
The Addams Family. All right. How about, so this is a new question. The next three are the new ones I added. Okay. So we can edit these out if you don't want. But anyway, tell us about the best crop you ever grew. Like, what was your favorite, most successful, something that just was, wow, I'm so glad that was the best year.
Oh, well, like, tomatoes, like I said, are my favorite. So I feel like I really make a priority to, like, prune and inspect and, like, overly nurture my tomato plants. But last year, like, I've recently been super turned on by hot peppers. I just, like, love peppers of all hot variety. So I grew a couple habaneros and a couple jalapenos, which, you know, in the scheme of hot peppers aren't that hot. But the jalapenos and habaneros, and then there's, like, ghost peppers. So I'm excited to kind of expand on that. But last year I did really well with all of them. And then last year was, like, my year for peppers and eggplant. It's like two things that a lot of my clients don't necessarily want. They're like scared of the hot peppers because they have little kids and they don't want the kids to touch the pepper leaves and then touch their faces, which I totally get. But I had, I have like all these eggplant varieties too that a lot of people weren't interested in. I don't know. We don't have a lot of nightshade takers, I guess. And so I had, my personal garden was like loaded with eggplant and hot peppers, and I was so happy. I had a couple heirloom varieties of eggplants that were just amazing. So
can I just ask, Do you have any secrets for making your eggplants grow successfully? Because they're hard to grow here, and I've talked to a few people. Like, my husband gets beautiful eggplants and the purple flowers, but then actually getting them to produce an eggplant has been a challenge. He's come a long way, and he's getting more and more. But if there's any
do you
tips.
Start them inside? Like, mm-hmm. I don't know how. Yep. Okay, yeah. So I guess like getting the jump on the season, because starting them as early as you can, I guess, and then putting them out as soon as you can, because, you know, they do have like a long growing window. But the other thing is too, is that I kind of treat them the same way I treat my tomatoes, which is really, I don't overly prune them, but I definitely pull off a lot of the leaves to kind of make more flowering. So I just kind of prune them a good bit. I take off a lot of the green so that I get a lot of flowers and I get a lot of fruit. And I found that, like, you know, all those quick fixes like fish emulsion and chicken scat and stuff like that, you know, you'll get a lot of leaf growth, but you won't get a lot of fruit. So I don't really, yeah, like those liquid fertilizers often produce a lot of leaf, but not a lot of fruit. So out here, because I'm on Long Island, like trace minerals are really important. So on Long Island, I have the benefit of having beaches everywhere. So we get a lot of like oyster shells and crush them. And we feed a lot of oyster shells to the plants so that they get like calcium. I think trace minerals are like, you know, you gotta have to watch your NPK, but all the other pieces are really important too. So it's the things that you're less likely to have in your soils that they really need, I think, to get a lot of fruiting.
That's interesting. And we use a lot of chicken manure, so I wonder if that's kind of...
Yeah, like nitrogen will give it like a good boost in leaf production, but it won't necessarily produce more fruiting.
Okay.
So,
right.
Yeah, if you can add like the calcium and, you know, other minerals that they might need.
Okay.
That's kind of what I, yeah.
Nice. Okay. How about, what is the best gardening advice you have ever received?
Ooh. Oh, I know this one. This is easy. Okay. the best gardening advice I ever received. So when I worked on Greenview Farm in Rhode Island, my boss had prior been a sous chef. And so he like loved growing veggies for restaurants. So we had a couple really nice restaurants that he grew things for. And he, so we would pick baby squash, like super tiny squash, to serve to the restaurants, to sell to the restaurants. And he would always say soft hands when you go to pick them, because if you've ever tried to pick a zucchini or any sort of like patty pan squash or something, you know that if you don't pull it off the right way, it breaks in your hands and you have, like, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Have you? Okay. So I honestly think with gardening, soft hands is really important. I think it's a super important thing because if you're, it's like the, it's such a small little thing to say, but at the same time, it's like all encompassing the big picture, which is like work with nature. Don't work against it. It's like we always think that, you know, if you see a beautiful bell pepper in the supermarket, that that's what your garden's going to look like. But guess what? The person who grew your bell pepper is like a trained farmer, and they also grew acres of peppers, and they picked the very best one to go to your supermarket. So if you're a home gardener, like, work with nature. Don't work against it. Everything is not going to be perfect all the time, but this is your effort that you put into it. So enjoy the fruits of it and take them for what they are and learn as you go, but soft hands.
Nice.
Soft hands when you're picking stuff.
Which activity is your least favorite activity to do in the garden?
I think my least favorite thing is shutting it down. Like, I'd really like to be able to, all of my own personal gardens, I would love to have them going four season, but it's just not happening at this point. So I think shutting the season down is sort of like the sad part for me, but that's okay.
All right. And then how about your favorite activity to do in the garden?
My favorite activity. Sometimes my favorite activity is at the end of the day, sitting there looking at it and just thinking up ways that I might want to change it or alter it or do something different in the following year. I think sitting down and looking at it is probably my favorite thing to do, which is hard for me because I like to move a lot.
Nice.
I don't sit down very well. But when I do, I really like to look at it and just take it in.
Cool. How about a favorite tool that you like to use? Like, if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what would it be?
My shovel, because it is everything. It can scrape your boots. It can cut strings. It can do anything you need it to do. Definitely the shovel. I think it's like the one tool that you need, and you probably don't need anything else.
Nice. All right. How about eating or harvesting vegetables or fruit on time? That's definitely my biggest challenge before they go bad. And
okay.
Getting them eaten after I pick them.
Yeah. So I always tell my clients that, like, if it smells good to you, it smells good to them. And by them, I mean, like, any rodent or critter that might be living, you know, in your property, on your property. So I always tell people, I encourage people to kind of take things a little prematurely, especially the tomatoes, because truly tomatoes start to smell really good when they become ripe. And that smell, you can smell it and animals can smell it. So I've kind of trained some people, if they don't want to have a pest problem and rodents in the garden, to take things like as a tomato shoulders start to turn color, take it inside. And that's been a hard lesson for a lot of my clients to absorb, because a lot of people are like, what about a vine ripened tomato? I'm like, it will ripen, it will be sweet, it will taste fantastic, but I don't like to share my harvest with the raccoons. Like, I don't want to have a bite out of my tomato. And I don't know. I mean, where I live, it's a little more populated, I think, than where you are. So we have a ton of rodents. Like, mm-hmm. we have rats and we have raccoons mm-hmm. and we have mice and mm-hmm. squirrels. So it's
and
like
rabbits. There's like a huge overflowing population of rabbits in my mom's town. They are everywhere. It's crazy.
Yeah. We have a lot of raccoons, and they love tomatoes. So I've tried to sort of train people, like, if you don't want to have a pest problem, take these things now. Also, another thing I always tell clients, like, especially with things like bush beans or pole beans, it's if you don't pick the beans when they're the right size, they're going to grow and they're not going to taste as good. Mm-hmm. And then you're also stunting the plant's growth. So if you want to have a constant supply of beans, keep picking. Pick, you know, twice a week so that your plant will keep producing. But if you leave things on there that are long and inedible and won't taste good, then your plant's going to slow down in production and eventually start to die off. So if you constantly pick, you'll have a better harvest.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. How about secrets for preserving food or making it last after you've harvested, like freezing or canning or any of that kind of thing?
I'm a big freezer. Mm-hmm. So we grow a lot of butternut squash and zucchini and yellow squash and tomatoes. And so I'm a big freezer. Like, I'll cut up butternut squash and throw it in freezer bags and throw it in the freezer. I would love to jar, but I just don't have the mm-hmm. ability to do that.
If you're cutting up butternut squash, do you cook it or you just throw it in the freezer raw? Do you plant
So what I like to do with it is I cut it up and I roast it, and then I kind of stick it in like a food blender, and so it's like a mash, and then I just throw it in bags and throw it in the freezer. So when I want to make butternut squash, like all winter, when I want to make butternut squash soup, I just pull the bags out, and then I use them as the base. Yeah.
No, I just have to ask.
Can,
go ahead.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
Since you said you grow a lot of squash and pumpkins, my mom, one of her favorite recipes is she fries the flowers into like a fritter. Do you ever do that? Have you tried
that? Yeah.
Those are good.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, the flowers are phenomenal. I love to use the flowers. Sometimes I got a good tip from a friend once to dip them in pancake batter and then make like squash blossom pancakes. They're so good. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Do you have any special techniques for cooking weird or any unusual foods? Something people maybe never heard of or don't usually, maybe probably in your, you probably get people who are like, what's this? Even just with some regular things like Swiss chard. So some people are like, I don't know, Swiss chard or eggplant or.
No, you know what? I think in the summertime, like I always tell people, you know, sometimes people will say, yeah, I want Swiss chard or whatever. And then they realize that like two plants of Swiss chard actually produces quite a bit. So I always tell people, like, if it's greens, like just wilting things with olive oil and salt tastes phenomenal. Like, just try doing that, you know? I'm sort of like a 3 or 4 ingredient chef. Like, I think if you have to get too many ingredients, I'm not that creative when it comes to cooking. So I feel like I think less is more in terms of how much you're putting in your food. Mm-hmm. But I do love the Moosewood cookbook, and there's many different editions of that. I know she's like redone a couple of years. So that's like for somebody who's gardening, Moosewood cookbook has a ton of like fresh ingredients in it, and it's very simple to follow and nothing obscure. So,
all right. The other day I was talking about one of my favorite recipes is the chili and squash out of there. Have you tried that?
Yeah.
And I make it with pumpkin a lot. Yeah.
Ooh, yum.
That's one of my favorite recipes.
She has like a peanut sauce recipe that's very simple to follow if you want to put that sauce on anything. And her cornbread recipe is very simple.
That pie crust is like, let me tell you, if I can make a pie crust that's flaky and it works almost every time.
Yeah.
That's my definite go-to pie crust. I love the Moosewood cookbooks, Molly Katzen. Yum. All right. How about a favorite recipe you like to cook from your garden?
Gee, I don't know. Favorite recipe from the garden. I do like a tomatoes again. I do a cold tomato, cucumber, dill salad that I love. That sometimes I put feta cheese in. So it's like cucumber, tomato, dill, feta cheese, sometimes like a little apple cider vinegar and salt, and it's so good. Everybody seems to like that. And sometimes I throw like a tiny bit of mint in there. It tastes really good. And you can even add, if you wanted to, you could add watermelon to that, and it would taste phenomenal.
Mint with the dill or mint separate than the dill?
I've done both, or I've done one or the other. Yeah. I constantly have like a abundant supply of herbs, and that I try putting in everything because there's so many of them, but I dry a bunch for later, but I'll kind of just throw a bunch together. Yeah.
How about a favorite internet resource?
Oh, so I love Stone Barns Center, which is here in New York. They have something called the Virtual Grange, which is if anybody wants to like begin farm or talk about farming or raising animals, The Virtual Grange is amazing. I also like the Cornell Cooperative Suffolk County Extension. That's great for Long Island because it'll tell you when to plant what the common pest for that plant is, and different varieties that do well on Long Island. So I think those are both great.
Nice. How about a favorite reading book, magazine, a blog, something?
Yeah, I live by my Rodale organic gardening book. It's nice. Like the Bible. I used to just, in winter, just sit and read it like a book.
Uh-huh.
And then during the height of the season, I reference it constantly. It's like the best book. It's just Rodale Organic Gardening.
I know. And I love Rodales. They were definitely my biggest inspiration for starting this podcast is to spread.
Oh.
I love the test garden. Like back in 2000 or 2003, somewhere around there, I first got my subscriptions to Organic Gardening Magazine. And I read about that farm trial that they have down there where they do a test side by side. They've been doing it since, I think, 1947. And they compare... Mm. And they have all the data from comparing conventional agriculture to organic agriculture. And, in a perfect environment, the conventional agriculture will produce more. But when are you ever going to have a perfect environment where you get exactly the right amount of rain, the exact amount of sun, the exact amount of, warmth without the freeze, without everything? And they said, unless, any other time, the organic produces more every time. And so, and especially in droughts, and just they talked about how important it is to feed the world. And we have the technology, we have the capability, and we just need the willpower. And that just totally inspired me.
Yeah. Yeah. Rodale's amazing, and the work they do is phenomenal. And they're really at the forefront of helping organic farming and organic gardening sustain. So I think it's also just so good to have the wealth of knowledge and history that they have, because that's data that's on your side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I also love Four Season Harvest by Elliot Coleman. He's amazing too. He's somebody who's just at the forefront of really helping the organic movement push forward. And he has a couple books out there, but Four Season Harvest is great because it just goes to show that here on Long Island, you really can garden and farm four seasons. So we're lucky that way.
Nice. I'm going to have to look at that. Somebody else recommended that one. Okay. So now here's your chance to tell us about your business. And, you talked a little bit about it, but I'm just really intrigued because especially as a teacher, I think it's, so important to get the gardening into the schools. And I love the idea of going to people's places on a personal level and building gardens in people's, because I bet that takes a lot of the intimidation out of it and gets them. I just think that's a great idea. So do you want to share?
Yeah, I guess. So the reason I started the kitchen garden business is because here on Long Island, even though we do have organizations that are securing agricultural land for up and coming farmers, it's very expensive to live here and it's very expensive to lease land. Whether you're leasing land from a farm, from another farmer, or you're leasing land from a county or the state, it's expensive and there's a lot of red tape. So one of the easier ways to go about this is to kind of teach people how to do it themselves and use their own backyards. And so what we decided was we wanted to teach people how to be vested in the food that they consume and learn how the food is grown. And we wanted to help teach them how to do that. So we use our clients' backyards. We basically install, most of the time, raised beds in their backyards. We help them with irrigation. We help them with fencing. And then we maintain the garden for them. We do one-on-one instructions with our clients to really empower them to do it themselves so that they rely less on us and they have a better handle of what's happening in their garden, because ultimately it's theirs. And without their participation, it really wouldn't work. They need to be a part of it too. So we have three schools. One Montessori school, which is just like my favorite garden to do, because at the Montessori, the children help build the box beds. They help fill the box beds. They grow the plants in the classroom, and then they plant them in the garden. They are so hands-on. It's just awesome. And we get to do a lot of plant genetics and talk about, we just get to do a lot of
now,
classes
how old are
based around.
How old are these kids?
So K through six. So, yeah, so it's fun. Oh, and the best part about the Montessori is that the kids actually get to eat it. We harvest it, we wash it, and then we serve it. So it's just the beginning to end. It's just awesome. Some of the other schools is like a little bit more red tape, so they can do taste testing around the garden, but they can't really bring it into school and eat it, which is something that there's a lot of parents and legislators trying to work on. And the farm to school movement is really blowing up, especially here in New York. So I'm very confident that within the next year or two, that that'll be some red tape that will not hinder us getting food into the cafeterias. I think that farm to school is amazing. I don't know if you're from, do you know about the National Farm to School Network?
No.
It's really cool. Oh, you got to check it out. National Farm to School Network. And they're basically, getting farm fresh food into schools, and the point of it is to sort of source the food as locally as possible and then just get farm fresh food right into schools, whether it starts with salad bars and they get
well, I even think like the schools cook so many potatoes and so many carrots alone. If they just got their potatoes and their carrots locally, that would be huge.
The fact that you're even telling me that they cook something at the school that you're referencing is phenomenal, because here there's no food cooked. There is box cutters and there's baking trays and there's chicken nuggets and french fries and ketchup is the vegetable. And that's what gets served at the public schools here. And it's very
disturbing.
But
where do they get the french fries from?
I have no idea. It wasn't a potato. It wasn't a potato farmer. I have no clue, but there's a huge movement here and a big push to improve school lunches. And it can be done. It truly can be done. It just, you know.
Okay. So now this is my thing that's gone over in my head about putting gardens in schools that I have not figured out. So maybe gardens grow in the summer and kids are not at school in the summer. So how does that work?
Right. Well, we do spring gardening, so the kids pretty much get, they get like a quick crop of strawberries right before they head out, right before they're out in June. So they do get like a crop of strawberries. They get tons of greens, like we grow lots of lettuces, which is fun because, you know, we'll do spicy things, we'll do things that are colorful. We do a ton of spinach, we do a ton of Swiss chard. So they do, it really lends itself to a salad bar. We also do carrots. And then I prepare the gardens when they come back so that they are coming back in September and there are things that are established and ready for them to harvest. So, you know, they'll have cucumbers. They might have some cherry tomatoes. So there are things that are kind of finger foods. We try not to do anything that needs to be cooked because of, you know, the fact that they can really only taste test at the garden. They can't really bring it into the cafeteria and serve it in two of the schools that they service. So,
that is so interesting. I wouldn't think that, I don't know. I would be surprised if that was a problem out here. It could very well be. And I would be, I don't know. And then the other thing is our kids are out of school so much earlier. Like my nieces in New York go to school almost a month later than our kids here. Like we're out the end of May, and they usually go to the end of June.
Oh yeah, we're September to June, so we go. The kids are into like the end of June, so they do have. So I mean, there's ways to do it, but really, it's truly only successful if you have either parental involvement or you have faculty involvement, because it is something that needs tending to, and it's. But it can be so phenomenal because. You know, we had like PE projects going with the kids and they were setting up Punnett squares and we were talking about genetics and like, it's just, there's so much that they can learn from it. And it's just great. And I think also a lot of the time we shortchange kids with what we think that they'll eat. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't think that they'll eat raw vegetables or we don't think that a kid would even want to eat an eggplant or
oh my goodness, could they eat those raw vegetables?
But they're eating it at home. It's like my kids go to public school and now they see like mac and cheese and you know, a weird piece of pizza, and they're like, I don't want to eat that. Like, that doesn't look like what my mom gives me. So they won't even eat, you know, the subsidized lunches at school.
Nice. So the one that I struggle with is like, they don't serve raw broccoli or raw carrot sticks or raw celery out here without ranch dressing. It's always got to come with this little cup of ranch dressing. And I'm like, are you kidding?
Yeah.
And like, even when I worked at Head Start, and they, you know, and I probably do in the schools too, you know, they're counting every calorie, you know, they're making sure of every little nutritional thing. And I'm like, why do we have to have ranch dressing with every time we have a salad? Why do we have to, why is this ranch dressing here? You're telling me it's one of the most fattening things, you know, you're looking at your whole week and saying, well, I can only have ranch dressing here and here. I'm like, why does a kid have to have ranch dressing to eat a carrot stick?
It's interesting, even what we teach, even what we teach as to be current day nutrition in the public schools is so intriguing to me, because my son just left Montessori and is now in a public school environment. And we had this like argument with his health teacher, because she basically told him the other day that like no food is a drug. And I was like, really? Because sugar kills more people than anything else in this country. So
and
you
what
can't
about
tell
coffee?
Me that. That's what I said. I said, well, you need. So I told my son,
I mean,
the poor thing, because I said to him, I'm like, listen, I'm like, you know the answer she's looking for. So put that on the test. I'm like, but at home, you know that whole milk is actually really good for you. You know, it's like, it's so funny. It's like such an antiquated thing that we're teaching the kids. And I understand it. It's a hard pill to swallow sometimes, that, you know, what we're teaching the kids in school is not necessarily what I would teach my son about health and nutrition. So it's interesting.
I was just listening to a different podcast called The Model Health Show last night, and he was talking about diabetes and obesity and the epidemic in our country and our kids.
Yeah.
And it just was full of tons of facts and interesting stuff. I'm going to go to our final question. If there was one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? Like, for example, is there a charity or an organization you're passionate about, or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the earth, either in your local area or a national or global scale?
Holy goodness. I don't know if I can say it's any one thing.
What's the most, go ahead.
Well, I mean, you know, food, you are what you eat. So, I mean, food is at the forefront of, you know, changing our health and our planet and the way our health system's structured. Food is very important, but I would have to say, in order to grow healthy food, we also need clean water. And, you know, so, you know, those things kind of go hand in hand. But I think if there was something that I really want to see change, I really think I would want to see more schools participating in the National Farm to School Network and really getting farm fresh food into the schools and getting processed foods out of the schools. Because if we teach children at a young age to care about what they eat and what proper nutrition is, and packaged items and canned goods are not necessarily the best things for our health and our well-being. If we can really change that, then we can change, you know, future generations by starting now. I really think teaching these children, you know, correct nutrition and offering them things that, you know, we don't think they'll eat, but they will. It's like they will eat carrots, they will eat celery, they will eat broccoli, they will eat spinach, they'll eat greens. Just present it in its whole form and let them make the decision. And take away the sugary things out of the vending machine. Take away the soda. Take away the, you know, high fructose corn syrup. Because if you feed them something healthy, their brains function better and they're less likely to be depressed and they're less likely to be obese, which is less of a drain on our whole healthcare system. You know, so.
And that's
I think food
there's
is
also
very, very
all
important.
The exercise you get from gardening too, which is so important for these kids. And they love it.
Well,
they love it. Besides,
they even say children with like severe ADHD and things like that, the most comforting environment for them is nature, because there's less stimulation. There's less coming at them. There's, you know, it's a very technological world, which is great in some aspects. But being in nature, there's a very soothing component to that and a very natural rhythm that you know, I think is very important for a child's development.
That almost brings tears to my eyes because I had never thought about that, probably because I've never seen an ADHD kid out in nature because you don't get to have those opportunities.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's so important. That's
awesome. Yeah, it is. It is. It's kind of less stimulus coming at you and more peace and nature. You know, it's a good thing. So I think all children should be, you know, mandatory outside at least an hour a day at minimum. Mm-hmm. I love it. I think Joel Salatin once said, he said something like, if your kid hasn't eaten a pallet of dirt by the time they're five, you know, then they're not living. And I was like, oh, I totally buy that.
Should we use that for your inspirational quitter tip or quote? Sorry. Or did you have one planned?
I don't know. You could. No, no.
Because that's the very end. Do you have an inspirational tip or a quote to help motivate our listeners to reach into that dirt and start their own garden?
Yeah. I mean, I think it sounds a little daunting and it sounds a little sad, but this is the first generation of children that are not going to outlive their parents due to childhood diseases. And that does sound daunting and it does sound terrible, but what better reason to get involved in the good food movement? You are what you eat.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people don't realize that if we don't do something, that the, you know, the last, that there's kids already born today that might not see, our planet might not still be here. Those kids are already born. Yeah. They're saying the climate changers are predicting that those kids are already born that are not going to live. Our planet's not going to support them the way it, certainly not the way it does today, this same planet, and what changes they're going to have to. Anyway, on a better note to leave off, did you have something that you wanted to? Or
yeah, you know, I think that this is the time. There's so much happening in the good food movement right now. I think, you know, I think it's a great time to start a food endeavor. I think it's a great time to try and get good food into public schools. I think it's a great time to, you know, be doing anything in this movement, whether it's educating people about, you know, proper nutrition. And I think, you know, there's a real awakening and awareness that our food is something that needs to be improved. And so, you know, whether you're somebody who's great at pushing paper and wants to, like, help the school districts, or you want to get involved in legislation in your area to, you know, help small farmers succeed or help secure agricultural land, this is the time to do it because people really care about food right now. It's such an awakening. You know, we're out of this industrial revolutionary age where it's like, you know, dumping excess pesticides and chemicals on your food is nobody wants it. You know, and you're seeing it even in big box stores. I mean, you can buy organic produce in Target. So, you know, it's happening, and I think focusing on the positive and being part of the positive is very helpful in getting rid of the negative. And I think
nice.
I think we're really moving forward towards where we want food to be. So, you know, it you don't have to be good at gardening to help change the system. You just have to care. So anybody can be a part of it.
Thank you, Elizabeth, so much for being on my show today, sharing your incredible knowledge, sharing your inspiration, your optimism. Just, I love what you do, and thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having me. I was so honored to be asked. Thanks.
And I'll put the links to your website on the page. Is there a way you want people to connect with you if they have any questions or anything, or is that just the best way to reach out to you?
Website, we're on Facebook, and we're on Instagram, so you can find us any one of those ways.
Okay. All right. You have a great day. Enjoy that snow.
Thanks.
All right. Bye. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I would like to encourage you to visit our website at mikesgreengarden.wordpress.com/organicgardenerpodcast, where you can check out the links to everything we talked about today in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and remember, grow local.